Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for the chance to be together tonight. Thank you for great people in our lives, and great people that we know because we've been able to read them, and they've been able to influence us at a distance. And now, Lord, bless us as we look at the life of a great person, a complex person, a really an exciting person to get to know. So, Lord, bless us as we look at the life of Clive Staples Lewis. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Clive Staples Lewis was born in Belfast, November 29th, 1898. My dad was born in 1899, so I can always think of my dad and C.S. Lewis would have been the same age. His brother Warren was 3.5 years older than he was, and they were lifelong friends. His mother, her name was Flora Hamilton, and she was the daughter of a Church of England clergyman. His father, his name was Albert, and he was a solicitor. He was a good man, but he was a preoccupied man. And that plays a part in Lewis's life. So I will read what Warren, I'm going to read, do several readings so that Lewis can speak for himself. And in this case, Warren, his brother, can speak. Warren wrote the memoir at the beginning of the book, Letters and Papers of C.S. Lewis. And he has such an interesting insight that it'll help us understand the family that Lewis grew up in. He tells about how the mother, Flora Hamilton, was this warm and totally generous and humorous and wonderful mother that they absolutely adored. And then they had their holidays where they would go down to the beach. That was always something they looked forward to every summer. And then he says, but sometimes my father, on those such holidays, two pictures remain in my memory. The first is of my father's gloomy detachment. This is for their holiday now. If there's a gloomy detachment during the holiday, imagine what it was like during the rest of the year. He would sometimes come down for the weekend, but he never stayed with his wife and children throughout the summer holiday. Urgent business was his excuse. He was a solicitor. And he may have felt that 11 months of our company every year was enough. It may have gone deeper than that. This is Warren telling about his dad. And I'm a father, and I have three kids, and I thought, oh, man, how would you like your kids to describe you this way? This ought to shake up a lot of us to hear this. Warren said, I never met a man more wedded to a dull routine. or less capable of extracting enjoyment from life. A night spent out of his house was penance to him. A holiday he loathed, having not the faintest conception of how to amuse himself. I can still see him on his occasional visits to the seaside, walking moodily up and down the beach. And being English, he probably had full suit, tie, necktie, and everything. Walking up and down the beach, hands in trouser pockets, eyes on the ground, every now and then giving a heart-rending yawn, and then pulling out his watch. That's Lewis's dad. So that plays a part a little later, and you'll see when I have another reading about his father. Well, they lived in a house. By the way, that house is still in existence in Belfast. Little Lee, they called it. Lewis loved that house, and especially the attic where he and his brother used to play, and they created their whole empire called the Boxing Empire in that attic with little talking animals, especially mice. Lewis loved talking mice. If you're a Chronicles of Narnia fan, you'll appreciate that. And he drew them, too. Had lots of little pictures of little mice with their full suits and clothes on and everything, and top hats and all. He really loved that. And so they had their little empire up in the attic. But in 1908, his mother died. Before that, when he was 3 years old, Lewis came up to the family and said, I'm Jaxie. He didn't like Clive or Staples, evidently, as his name. And so he said to his family, I am Jaxie. And from that moment on, he was called Jax by his family and Jack by his friends. That's why if you read any books about C.S. Lewis, he's always referred to as Jack Lewis. Because when he was 3 years old, he says, I'm Jaxie. So it stuck. But at age 9, his mother died. And she died after a long 8-month illness of cancer. With all the whispering going on downstairs, as the boy being shunted upstairs with doctors and all, whispering around his mother and then her death. If you, again, are a Chronicles of Narnia fan, you'll see scenes that are echoes of that in Magician's Nephew. And that death was a devastating blow to this little boy. And think of it. Less than 1 month later, this 9-year-old boy was sent by his father off to England to go to a prep school. He was in four different schools. That begins up until age 16, a terribly unhappy period in Lewis's life. And if you read Surprised by Joy, he tells you about that in great detail, about the schools that he was in, how he hated them, how he was desperate. The only thing that was the bright light was going home every summer to Little Lee and get into his imaginary world with his friend Arthur Greaves, who lived across the way, and then his brother. But those years were very, very unhappy years. Here's how he describes it in Surprised by Joy. He says, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, those would be those summers, and many pleasures, and many stabs of joy, but no more of the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis." Isn't that, Lewis is the great describer, but isn't that poignant and powerful? This 9-year-old boy had this great continent who was his mother, Flora Hamilton, this wonderfully humorous and marvelous woman, and she died. And then he is, 1 month later, sent off to this very unhappy period in his life. He begins to plead regularly in letters to his father, "Take me away from this school." And then he was in another school, "Take me away from this school." Then he was in another school, "Take me away from this school." And finally, at age 16, he is, by his father, decides to put him with a tutor. The tutor's name is W.T. Kirkpatrick, and I have to tell you about this because this is absolutely fundamental in understanding Lewis and the later C.S. Lewis. W.T. Kirkpatrick, who was nicknamed by Lewis, nicknamed everybody. By the way, he nicknamed his father, too. He and his brother had nicknames for everybody. And the father was always referred to as O.A.B., Old Airbag. That was his father. And in their letters, they would always refer to Old A.B., O.A.B. But W.T. Kirkpatrick was nicknamed the Great Knock. He was a huge, tall man. And he had been tutored to Warren. Warren, remember, 3.5 years older, who was failing academically. And W.T. Kirkpatrick tutored him, and he got into Sandhurst as a result of it. So talk about a success story. This boy that was probably doing very poorly on SATs goes with W.T. Kirkpatrick, who was a brilliant man, and tutored Warren Lewis. And he got to become an officer in the British. He ended up being a major in the British Army, but he got to go to Sandhurst. So the father relented, said, okay, you can go and be with W.T. Kirkpatrick. At age 16, Lewis shows up to study with W.T. Kirkpatrick. Now, in Surprised by Joy, one of the most priceless, I think one of the priceless scenes in Surprised by Joy is Lewis describing what it was like to meet W.T. Kirkpatrick, the Great Knock, when he showed up. Think of this 16-year-old boy showing up at Surrey in northern England to be tutored, where he was until age 17, actually 18, from age 16 to 17, 18. He is tutored by W.T. Kirkpatrick. He gets out of the train at Surrey, and this is Lewis now describing meeting his tutor, who he'll live with as a private student for the next 2.5 years. And he gets out of the train, and I stole a glance at him. First, the old man was holding his fire. We shook hands, and his grip, though like iron pincers, was not lingering. A few minutes later, we were walking away from the station. "You are now," said Kirk, "proceeding along the principal artery between Great and Little Borncam." I stole a glance at him. Was he trying to conceal his emotions? His face, however, showed only inflexible gravity. I began to, quote, "make conversation," unquote, in the deplorable manner which I had acquired at those evening parties and indeed found increasingly necessary to use with my father. I have to explain that. When Lewis and his brother would go home for the summer, their father would sit them down. His father was brilliant, but he did have a flaw, several flaws. But one was that he would say to the boys, "All right, what are you learning? What's on your mind?" And the boys would start to maybe say something about sex or something like that, maybe that's an issue. And the father would listen for about 1 minute. It's like listening to, like, you know, have you ever had somebody from a religious cult come to your front door? And they listen for about 1 minute, and then they've got their speech. So the father would listen for about a minute, and here's what he would always say. Yes, I see it all clearly now. Which, of course, he didn't. And then he would pontificate and would give a lecture to the boys for 25 minutes. So the boys learned the trick of only talking about the weather. And talking about, they didn't dare bring up any subject that the father could then give a speech on. And again, I say that for you. I have a father. I'm a father. Fathers, mothers, beware. If your kids only talk to you about the weather, it's because they're afraid you'll give them a speech. So don't give any speeches, or you'll have your kids not willing to talk to you. So he said, I decided to make conversation, quote unquote, in the despicable or deplorable way that we had found increasingly necessary with our father. I said I was surprised at the scenery of Surrey. It was much wilder than I had expected. Stop, shouted Kurt, with a suddenness that made me jump. What do you mean by wildness? On what grounds have you for not expecting it? I replied, I didn't know, still, quote, making conversation, as answer after answer was torn to shreds. It at last dawned on me he really wanted to know. He was not making conversation, nor joking, nor snubbing me. He wanted to know. I was stung into attempting a real answer. A few passes suffice to show that I had no clear or distinct idea corresponding to the word wildness. And that, so far as I had any idea at all, wildness was singularly an inept word. And you know, you think about it, there's no place in England that's wild. Montana, yes. Hey, that's the word to say when you go to Missoula. Wow, this is wild. But there's no place around here that's wild. I've been here now long enough, I know. And you would never say, Bethesda is wild. You just wouldn't say it. I had expected it to be so wild. So if I found that it was an inept word. In, England is manicured, folks. Even the wild areas are manicured. So I had no idea what wild. It was a singular. And then Kirk goes on. Did you not see then, concluded the great knock, that your remark was meaningless? I prepared to sulk a little while, assuming that the subject would now be dropped. Never was I more mistaken in my life. Having analyzed my terms, Kirk was now proceeding to deal with my proposition as a whole. On what had I based, but he pronounced it bised, my expectation about the flora and geology of Surrey? Was it maps, or photographs, or books? I could produce none. It had, heaven help me, never occurred to me that what I called my thoughts needed to be bised on anything. See, if he already talked to about his dad about the weather, he didn't have to look him up in the paper. Kirk once more drew a conclusion without the slightest sign of emotion, but equally without the slightest concession to what I thought were good manners. Do you not see, then, that you had no right to have any opinion at all? And that's the way Lewis began his three years with W.T. Kirkpatrick. And I read that to you because I'll tell you something. Two things happened to Lewis under Kirkpatrick. One, he became an atheist. Kirkpatrick had been a Presbyterian, but now he stopped. Except, though he became an atheist, he still dressed up every Sunday. Even though he had been a Presbyterian, where you always dressed up on Sunday. So to do gardening, he dressed up. But he never went to church because he became an atheist. And he convinced young Lewis to become an atheist. And so that happened to Lewis under Kirkpatrick. And secondly, Lewis learned how to think under Kirkpatrick. And to know the meaning of words. And never to say anything that he couldn't explain. And I think the reason Lewis became such a great apologist for the Christian faith later is that Kirkpatrick was always looking over his shoulder. And he was always maybe trying to convince that man, W.T. Kirkpatrick, who he adored. He ended up adoring the man. And he wrote beautiful things. It's in this book about after the death of Kirkpatrick, of what an amazingly powerful person Kirkpatrick was in his life. So that's those 2.5 years. Lewis becomes brilliant in Latin and in Greek and in French and German. He becomes linguistically very competent. He passes exams to get into Oxford and wins honors in 3 different fields. His father, if Kirkpatrick got Warren into Sandhurst, he succeeded in getting Lewis into Oxford. And then the war came. And Lewis goes to Oxford and is is immediately called up by the British Army to go into war. And while he was at Oxford, he made a friend named Paddy Moore. And he met Paddy Moore's family in Oxford, his mother Jenny and his little sister Maureen. And she had him to the house, and they would eat dinner. And he had never seen his father. That was just not something his father did. And he just loved going into that home. And then he and Paddy, who became very best friends at Oxford, made a vow with each other. And this is an interesting insight into Lewis. Lewis is a man of duty. They made a vow that if either of them died in the war, the other would take care of the other's parent. Because Paddy Moore's mother was divorced, Jenny Moore, and had a little daughter to raise. Lewis's father was widowed. Well, Lewis got the bad end of that deal because nobody would ever take care of Albert Lewis. So if Lewis had died, believe me, Paddy Moore would never have had to take care of Lewis's dad. But Paddy Moore was killed in World War I, and Lewis kept the vow. He took care of Mrs. Moore till the day she died. She died in 1950. The last couple years of her life, she became totally with dementia, totally unable to recognize anybody. Lewis went every single day to the rest home to see her. Her own daughter didn't do that even. Lewis went to live with her, and many people thought it was a romance. It was not a romance. He always refers to Mrs. Moore as my mother, the woman who became my mother. His father hated Mrs. Moore. He did not like Mrs. Moore. No one liked Mrs. Moore. She was not a Christian. She was an oppressive lady. And Lewis made a vow. He moved in, stayed to her, and when he went to Oxford, developed his home at the Kilns. She stayed there. She had the nice room. He had a bad room. He took care of her, as I say, till the day she died. And so anyway, when he got back, though, from war, while he was wounded, he did, before that move-in with Mrs. Moore, he did try to reconcile with his father. Because his father had a falling out. During the time that he was at Oxford before he went to war. And this will give you some insight into that, sort of into the Mrs. Moore part, but it's some insight into the sadness of Lewis's relationship with his father, which, by the way, at the end, is reconciled. But listen to these letters he wrote. When Lewis was in an army hospital, first in the front in France, and then he was brought back and put in an army hospital in England and was there for some 6 or 7 months. And he had trench fever and had been, you know, badly wounded. In fact, he carried shrapnel in his body for the rest of his life, Lewis did. He writes to his father from the hospital in London. He says, "You know, I have some difficulty in talking about the greatest things. It's the fault of our generation." Notice, remember he said we always had these shallow conversations because I could never talk about great things with you. "But at least you will believe that I was never so eager to cling to every bit of our old home life and to see you. I know I have often been far from what I should have been in my relations to you and have undervalued an affection and a generosity which, as I said somewhere else, I experienced in other people's parents." That was Mrs. Moore, see. And all of this has shown me a new light, the importance of home. "Please, God, I'll do better in the future. Come and see me. I'm homesick. That's the long and the short of it." His father never came. He was only over at Belfast, and all he had to do was to come just across the English Channel, and Lewis was in there for some 5-6 months, and he never came. Finally, this sad letter was written in 1918. "Ever since my last letter to you, I've been almost daily expecting to hear from you, and I'm rather surprised that neither my answer to your proposal nor my suggestion that you should come over here has met with your reply. Have you not yet decided on a date for coming over? It's 4 months now since I returned from France, and my friends are now laughingly suggest that my father in Ireland, of whom they hear, is a mythical creation." And it's just so sad. And he never came. And I think that's why Lewis adopted Mrs. Moore. He tried to reconcile with his father, but his father was preoccupied and never came. Later, the father was very sad. In fact, as Lewis goes on to Oxford, now his father supports him all the way through Oxford. His father, and they did, at the end, before his father died, Lewis did have a really good reconciliation with his father. But he joined up with Mrs. Moore. And that, of course, his dad did not approve of at all, nor did Warren, his brother. And I'm going to read you Warren's memoir again about the Mrs. Moore period in Lewis's life, because, again, it'll give you some insight into this man. He says, Jack had many years earlier lost his mother, and now his father, too, seemed to have failed him emotionally. See, that's Warren talking about his dad. He may have felt also some sense of responsibility, a duty perhaps, in keeping a wartime promise that he made to Patty Moore. But be that as it may, Jack now embarked upon a relationship with Mrs. Moore, Mrs. Jenny Moore, which was almost a son and a mother. And as soon as the first year undergraduate was over, instead of moving from college to lodgings, he set up a joint menage with her and her daughter, Maureen. And having once embarked on this relationship with Mrs. Moore, it was not in Jack's nature later to abandon her. And she managed, in this menage, in fact, continued in existence until her death in 1951. During this period, now this is, mind you, this is from the early 20s until 1951. And during this period, Jack commonly referred to Mrs. Moore as my mother. And then a little later, Warren has this one more thing to say about Mrs. Moore. At Oxford, for more than 3 decades, Jack continued to live under the autocracy of Mrs. Moore, an autocracy that developed into stifling tyranny. And I myself experienced it during my years of inclusion into this incomprehensible menage. She ordered him around. She told him to do everything. She was no interest whatsoever in anything he was writing or anything about his faith. And that's why Lewis probably had all of his inkling meetings over at Oxford and his quarters at Oxford. But he kept the house and sustained her and took care of her, until the day she died. Now, at Oxford, he was made a tutor in English. In 1925, he became a tutor. And though he's an atheist, here's the interesting, curious thing about Lewis. He's an atheist, but he can't keep away from Christians. In fact, at one point he says to a friend, come and rescue me from these Christians or I'll end up in a nunnery. Because he seems to pick Christians as friends. And some of them are a little bit on the odd side and quirky side. Lewis had a lot of quirky friends, there's no question. But he was good at that. And Lewis had an amazing ability to make friends and to keep friends. I'm going to make a comment about that later. He was absolutely loyal, totally loyal man, loyal to Mrs. Moore, but loyal to friends. And so he started to collect friends. His best friend was Owen Barfield. And Owen Barfield was quirky, ended up in a kind of a quasi-cult himself. And Lewis never agreed with him on that after Lewis became a Christian. In the early period, it was Barfield that was sort of witnessing to Lewis about being a Christian. And Barfield's daughter is Lucy, and at one point, Lewis is made the godfather of Lucy, and that's why the Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, was written for Lucy Barfield. And that's why the chief character in the Chronicles of Narnia is a girl named Lucy, because she was the daughter of Owen Barfield. And Owen Barfield was his Christian friend, a quirky guy, but still his friend. Hugo Dyson, a scholar also at Oxford, was a Christian and his friend. Cecil Harwood was his friend, and Cecil Harwood was actually in a movement called the Anthroposophical Society, which was totally quasi-cultic, and he tried to get Lewis into that society, and Lewis just couldn't get into it. He thought it was just nonsense, but he was, again, a quirky Christian, and so Lewis had that friend, and then he had some literary friends that he kept running into that had an influence in his life. One was George MacDonald. He tells about that when he was just a boy, he was walking through the train station in Oxford, in London, and he saw a book by George MacDonald called Phantasis. He bought it and thought it was the most wonderful thing he ever read. And he's not even a Christian. He tells his friend Arthur Greaves how he found this amazing book by this man, George MacDonald. I don't know how many of you know of George MacDonald. He was a Scottish pastor, but he wrote novels, the Curdie novels. And he was an amazing guy. Had a wonderful generosity of spirit. In fact, I do wood carvings in the summer on my beach on driftwood. And I one of my favorite carvings is a George MacDonald quotation. God is impossible to satisfy, but easy to please. Isn't that great? That's George MacDonald. And George MacDonald had that wonderful generosity of spirit. Lewis read it, and he loved it. The other person he ran into, and he tells about it in Surprised by Joy, was when he was in France, and he was in his first French hospital recovering, he ran into G.K. Chesterton. I'm especially happy to read this to you because at Advent, we used a great G.K. Chesterton quote for our Advent series, The Visited Planet. Right in the middle of these things stands an enormous exception that God has visited this planet in person. And G.K. Chesterton wrote, he wrote novels, and he wrote for the press. He was a great journalist. He was much older than Lewis. Flamboyant man, about 6'7" tall, huge man, wore huge capes, was absolutely amazing. Great friend of George Bernard Shaw. Became a Roman Catholic at 1909, wrote a book about it called Orthodoxy, which I think is one of the finest books in the Christian faith I've ever read. And then he wrote The Everlasting Man in 1925. And so G.K. Chesterton was just this amazing personality, flamboyant personality. And in Surprised by Joy, Lewis tells about when he was in the French hospital, how he ran into the writings of G.K. Chesterton. Now listen, Lewis the Young Atheist, see what he says. It was here that I first read a volume of Chesterton, and I never heard of him. I had no idea what he stood for, nor can I quite understand why he made such an immediate conquest of me. It might have been expected that my pessimism, my atheism, and my hatred of sentiment would have made me, to him, the least congenial of all authors. It would almost seem that providence, or some second cause of a very obscure kind, quite overrules our previous tastes when it decides to bring two minds together. Liking an author may be as involuntary and improbable as falling in love. I was by now a sufficiently experienced reader to distinguish liking from agreement. I did not need to accept what Chesterton said in order to enjoy him. His humor, oh, I love this description of Chesterton's humor. Listen to this. His humor was of the kind which I like best, not jokes embedded in the page like currants in a cake. Still less what I cannot endure, a general tone of flippancy. Lewis hated that. Read Surprised by Joy. I mean, read the Screwtape Letters, you'll see. A tone of flippancy or jocularity. But the humor which is not in any way separable from the argument, but is rather, as Aristotle would say, the bloom of the dialectical itself. The sword glitters not because the swordsman set out to make it glitter. This is a great image, listen to this. But because he's fighting for his life, and therefore he's moving the sword very quickly. And that's why it glitters. And that's what he's saying about Chesterton. Listen to this. For the critics who think Chesterton frivolous or paradoxical, I have to work hard to feel pity for them. Sympathy is out of the question. Moreover, as strange as it may seem, I liked him for his goodness. We just had a Bible study a while ago that Barnabas was called a good man. I liked his goodness. He said, I didn't agree with it, but I liked it. So I put up with his Christianity because I liked his goodness and I liked his humor. And now I'll read this last line here. In reading Chesterton as in reading MacDonald, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. There are traps everywhere. Bibles laid open and millions of surprises. As George Herbert says, fine nets and stratagems. God is, if I may say it, very unscrupulous. Well, anyway, Lewis goes to Oxford from the French hospital experience, estranged from his father, joining up with Mrs. Moore, becomes a tutor, and makes friends with Christians, and he makes these quirky people become his friends, but the best friend of all is another man that was wounded in World War I, saw the horror of World War I like Lewis did, lost 4 of his best friends in World War I, came back wounded as well, also had trench fever, came back wounded, and decided to work out his post-traumatic stress syndrome, which many people feel that's what Lewis was doing when he wrote his novels. He was working out post-traumatic stress syndrome. because both of them saw horrific death in the battles they were in World War I, with mustard gas and everything. And that other man loved words and loved ideas and loved fantasy stories. And his name was J.R.R. Tolkien. And he became a professor at Oxford. And Tolkien and Lewis hit it off. They both lost their mothers when they were young. Tolkien also lost his father. Tolkien had become a Roman Catholic, devout. Tolkien went to Mass every day of his life. His son became a Roman Catholic priest. I've seen both of their graves in Oxford. These are heroes of mine, too. J.R. Tolkien, probably the greatest writer of fantasy stories in the history of literature, and his great friend, C.S. Lewis. And they met at Oxford. And guess how they met? They both loved stories of the marvelous. They loved fantasy stories. They loved Icelandic stories. They loved northern stories. And they had a study group. And the study group was Tolkien's. And Tolkien was very strict. He was a little older than Lewis. Tolkien said, if you want to be in my study group, you have to learn the Icelandic language. Because we're going to read about orcs and all in the Icelandic language. And Lewis did. Lewis is a linguistic buff anyway. So he learns Icelandic in order to be in Tolkien's study group. And that little study group meets. And they are reading fantasy literature together. And they become friends. Become very good friends. I have by the way, there are great books that I will advocate for you. If you want to really read on Lewis, the newest book on Lewis is marvelous, called The Narnian. Brand new book. And the best book on Lewis and Tolkien is Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship. Oh, this book came out about 2 years ago, is absolutely a masterpiece. And then this book, I met Lawrence Harwell in Oxford, in Cambridge this summer. He gave it to me himself and autographed it to me. He is the son of Harwell, the guy that I told you was the anthroposophist. And these are some letters in here that have never been published before that Lewis wrote to Harwell. So those are the newest books on Lewis, except also that book about Lewis's in the radio, giving the radio talk shows. All right. So Lewis and Tolkien become friends. And Tolkien is very devout Roman Catholic and begins to work on Lewis's atheism. And to make a long story short, first Lewis becomes a theist. He finally agrees that God exists. That was a big breakthrough. As he says in Surprised by Joy, I was the most unwilling convert in all of Europe when I finally did agree that God existed. But he did not know what to do with Jesus Christ. He was like Thomas Jefferson. He was a deist. But he couldn't figure out what to do with Jesus Christ. What do you do with him? Finally, he did agree, his friend Hugo Dias and all, finally got him convinced that Jesus was a person, a real historical figure. The New Testament histories were really histories. He got that far. But what do you do with him? And then one day they have a long talk, Lewis, Tolkien, and Hugo Dias. And this is all told about in the book, The Inklings, the book about Tolkien. And Lewis himself alludes to it in Surprised by Joy. They had a walk called the Addison Walk. And if you go to Oxford, you owe it to yourself to go to Magdalen College on High Street, where Lewis was a tutor, and take the Addison Walk. It goes through the Deer Park. All you have to do is pay £1, and you can walk through the Addison Walk. There's a poem of C.S. Lewis on a plaque in that walk. And take that walk, because during that long walk, Tolkien and Dyson talked with Lewis. And Tolkien created an argument with Lewis. And the argument was this: Lewis, you love stories of the marvelous. I love stories of the marvelous. And as you know that in every great story of the marvelous, there needs to be two things present in a great story. One, catastrophe. There has to be catastrophe. There has to be some great danger. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Remember the danger of the wicked witch who says, mirror, mirror, on the wall, who is fairest of them all? You know, if you are a reader of stories, the minute she says that on the wall, you've got a tragedy ahead of you. Because the mirror tells the truth, and the mirror is going to finally say, there's a Snow White girl out there. Snow White is more beautiful than you are. And then you know there's going to be a murder. That queen's going to become the wicked witch. Because if you know stories, that's the way stories are. The catastrophe. There's a sense of catastrophe. There's got to be, otherwise you don't have a story. Why have a story if you don't have a sense of catastrophe? And then Tolkien says, you know that. We love that in all of our stories. There's got to be a sense of danger, of catastrophe. And there needs to be, and here's a word that Tolkien himself created, there needs to be eucatastrophe. Now, in Greek, eu, it means good when it's put in front of a word. Take the word logos and put an eu in front of it, and you have the word eulogy, good word. Take the word phono in Greek and put eu in front of it, and you have euphemism, good sound. Take death, thanatos, and put eu in front of it, and you have euthanasia, good death. Oh, that's a bad one. Take angelos, the word for message, and put eu in front of it, and you have euangelion, gospel. So eu in front of a word means good. Okay. Tolkien takes the word catastrophe and says, but you know, if there's a catastrophe in every great story also has to have a eucatastrophe, eu, catastrophe. And then Tolkien said to Lewis, Jesus Christ is the eucatastrophe of all time. Except whereas in our stories, it's in our imagination. He is true. The next day, Lewis got in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle to ride to Whipsnade Zoo. And that's how he ends the Surprised by Joy, saying, Whipsnade Zoo has changed. I still remember Whipsnade Zoo. And he rode in his brother's sidecar to Whipsnade Zoo. He wrote this. He wrote this to Arthur Greaves. And he said, at the beginning of the sidecar ride, I did not believe in the deity of Christ. At the end of the ride, I believed in the deity of Christ. Nothing happened during the ride. He wants to keep the Pentecostals quiet. He doesn't want to have, oh, I had some great moment like on the road to Damascus. No, you don't want that. Nothing happened during the ride. But then he wrote to Arthur Greaves, nothing happened during the ride, but the long talk last night with Tolkien and Dyson had much to do with it. Lewis came to believe that Jesus Christ was Lord. He never wavered from that. He had moments of doubt, but he never wavered from that. And that was 1931. And he became a Christian. Well, the rest of the story. After that, he started to write books. I'm going to tell you about that tomorrow. Next week, I'm going to tell you about all the books he wrote. Because Lewis is a writer and a friend of writers, for sure. And I'll just give you some hints of it now. He wrote, and he stayed a tutor. He made a mistake, probably, in his first book, because it was called Pilgrim's Regress. And as a result of that book, the professors at Oxford were very upset about that book because they felt he was writing out of his field, and they penalized him for that. And did you know that for the rest of his career at Oxford, he was tutor? He was never a professor. Tolkien three times promoted him for professor, and three times he was defeated for professor. Even though by the end, he was the most famous teacher there at Oxford. Time magazine put his picture on the cover of Time magazine. Of course, that did him in for Oxford, for sure. And they defeated him for every election. And then finally, Cambridge University honored him by making him professor of medieval literature at Magdalen College in Cambridge. And then Oxford quickly made him professor in humiliation. In fact, when I spoke at the C.S. Lewis Institute event in Oxford on the occasion of his 100th birthday, we went to a big meeting at the Sheldonian, and the rector of Oxford University, that'd be the president of Oxford, started the meeting by saying, we, because the British had just struck a stamp in honor of Lewis, and they were honoring him there at Oxford. And he said, because he loved Oxford. And they said, we at Oxford treated C.S. Lewis shabbily. But that other school, see, Oxford will never mention the name of Cambridge. That other school honored him. So anyway, he was a tutor. All that time a tutor. Now, I have to tell you about, the reason I'm telling you that is, being a tutor, he didn't have the advantages of being a full professor at Oxford, which is really an easy job. You only have to give about one lecture, maybe sometimes two or three lectures a week or a month. You know, you have teachers, teaching assistants and tutors who read all the papers of students. You do not have to meet with students except maybe the couple PhD students you're working with. And you have an easy street. Lewis, being a tutor, had to meet with students regularly. He had to read student papers. He had to have student office hours. He had less income. He had to live on campus, required to live on campus and eat at the high table. And all these things did him great good. Why is Lewis able to relate to students so well? He read their papers. He knew what they were thinking. So not being promoted, the Peter principle didn't take over, being promoted to your area of incapability. And he being punished as a tutor. Actually, you'll notice when he wrote Screwtape Letters, it says C.S. Lewis, tutor at Oxford. In an American university, you can't do that because after so many years, if you're not promoted, you're out. But they don't work that way in the English university system. So he was tutor until in the 50s when he became at Cambridge. So in 1952, he started writing the Chronicles of Narnia. I'm going to tell you more about that because I'm going to devote a whole lecture to that. And a woman in America and her husband began to correspond with him, named Joy Davidson Gresham, and her husband. They were both communists. In fact, when McCarthy had the hearings here in, for the Hollywood scriptwriters, remember, the Anti-American Committee on Anti-American Activities had hearings on the Hollywood scriptwriters that were communists. One of those communist scriptwriters was Joy Davidson, and she was blackballed at Hollywood, and also her husband for that. She was a member of the American Communist Party. But she had read the Chronicle of Narnia, the first one, Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, and she started corresponding with Lewis. And out of that correspondence, she and her husband both, though it didn't stick with him, she and her husband, she was Jewish in her background, Davidman, and out of that, she became a Christian. She and then her husband and she, her husband was a very, he was a very brutal man. They had two little boys, David and Douglas. She came to England, and in England, she came to write a book as a Christian. She wrote a book called Smoke on the Mountain, which I still think is the finest book on the Ten Commandments I've ever read. Joy Davidson, C.S. Lewis wrote the introduction to it. A great commentary as a Christian on the Ten Commandments. And she corresponded with C.S. Lewis. And if you've seen the movie Shadowlands, it tells you very accurately what happened. She corresponded with Lewis, and finally Lewis and his brothers invited her up. This has got to be the funniest scene in the world, is when she showed up at the Eastgate Hotel, Lewis and his brother, two old bachelors, sitting there. Joy Davidson walks in and says, and she is very brash, American. She had a kind of a salty way about her, used a lot of profanity. And she stood up and said, anybody named Lewis around here? And because they were going to meet her there, and they raised their hand. And that's the way he met Joy Davidson. And she and her two boys came to their home, and they had Thanksgiving dinner. Or they didn't have Thanksgiving. They had a dinner there for him and all. And Lewis was very much impressed with her, and she showed him the manuscript she was writing on the Ten Commandments. He was totally impressed. It wasn't romantic. And then Britain decided to deport her because she was a member of the American Communist Party. And they were going to deport her. Lewis was outraged. And so, now folks, this is a controversial part of Lewis's life. He and his brother went down to the registry office. She came up to the registry office, and he married her so that she couldn't be deported. And nobody knew about it. He didn't take Tolkien in on that. By the way, that caused a breach in the relationship with Tolkien. Tolkien did not approve of her at that point. But he did that, but no one knew. He married her so that she could not be deported. And then she got cancer. And if you saw Shadowlands, it's all true. Shadowlands, especially the American version of Shadowlands, is so marvelous. And she went to the hospital, and Lewis went to the hospital. She is technically his wife, and he fell in love with her. And an Anglican priest married them in the hospital room. They thought she would never get out of the hospital room. She did. She got out of the hospital room. They had two wonderful years together. They even made a trip to Greece and came back, and then the cancer came back, and she died at age 45 in 1960. Leaving him with these two little boys. She was estranged, and her husband was out of the picture then completely. Lewis wrote a book about it called The Grief Observed, telling about that experience, but he published it anonymously under the name C.N. Clerk. And then people came up to Lewis because he grieved so much at the loss of Joy Davidson. And people came up to Lewis and said, Dr. Lewis, we have read a book that we think will comfort you. And and then he had to admit that he wrote that book. So if you get the book now, it says C.S. Lewis. But it was originally published, C.N. Clerk. And that is a very moving book. I'm going to read from that next week when I do his writings for you. She died in 60. Lewis then died in 63 as a very young man, not even 64 years old. He died at the same age as Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was 63. He died on the same day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, November 22nd, 1963. Lewis was a remarkable man. He was fiercely loyal. He was quick. He was quick-witted. He was strong-willed. He was vulnerable. He was a man of duty. He was generous. He was reserved. He was handsome, especially as a young man. Later, he became rumpled as a teacher. A little bit dowdy in his older age, but when he was young, he was very handsome. He was strict as a professor. He had a hearty and a huge voice. He was shy. He was romantic in his later years. As a writer, how would you describe him? Let me just give you something to tease you for next week. As a writer, he was a describer par excellence. He could describe like no one. You already got a hint of it in what he said about Chesterton. Let me give you just two fun examples of Lewis as a describer. Remember I told you about Harwell and how Harwell was in a cult? When Lewis was in his 20s, he kept a diary. He stopped it in 1926. It's the only diary we've got. It's called All My Road Before Me. But in it, we get these very interesting insights into Lewis the atheist. And Harwell invites him to go to his Anthroposophical Society. And I got to read Lewis's impression of the Anthroposophical Society. Listen to his descriptions. It's a little bit, it may be a little offensive to some who hear this, but I'll read it. Harwell and I left soon as he persuaded me to go with him to the Anthroposophical Society, chiefly, I think, to pull my leg. We had to take a taxi, arriving at a quite innocent-looking house. Notice his description. How would you talk a house as an innocent-looking house? An innocent-looking house, we climbed many stairs into a small and insufferably hot room, where some 12 people of various sexes... Lewis has this tremendous sense of humor. Of various sexes and ages sat together. I was introduced to a plain and rather crushed-looking woman. How do you like that as a description? A rather crushed-looking woman, Mrs. Kaufman. Harwood told me that I was quite new to the game. She said it would be rather difficult for me having my first lecture at this stage of the course. Cults always say that. See, that's so you'll pay more money to get the preface course. Having my first lecture at this stage of the course, but she had, perhaps I shouldn't say that. I don't know how much you've done. And I said to myself, well, I'm an absolute neophyte in this sort of business. And then Mrs. Kaufman, oh, that means that you condemned it beforehand. Self, I don't think you can really take that meaning out of the words. Shortly after this, Barfield came. Remember, he was in the Anthroposophical Society too. Barfield came, and he sat between him and Miss Oliver. Kaufman himself now appeared, a very dark, smooth-shaven, broad-browed man with a sort of unction about him. He sat down at a desk with his wife just beside him and read us his lecture in a very impressive manner, letting his dark eyes rest on everyone in turn with a sort of sugar-sweet, spiritual familiarity, a priestly type, beyond doubt. But he came out best in question time after the lecture when a number of very shy, rather silly and good-hearted, ordinary girls. I told you, some people, maybe some feminists might be a little offended at that. But that's Lewis. He said it. I'm just reading what he said. When a number of very shy, rather silly and quite good-hearted, ordinary girls put questions to him, beginning with stammers and hesitations, and ending with little bursts of gush. And then they would dart back into their holes, frightened at the sound of their own voices. At this time, he would lean forward with an indescribable expression of encouragement, helping them out and saying in by every gesture, "Yes, yes, I at least understand you, my dear. What a lovely soul you have." It disgusted me. So that's the young atheist with the Anthroposophical Society. And if you get this book, which is a brand new book by the son of Harwood, you can see some serious letters Lewis wrote to Harwood telling him how he thought the nonsense of the Anthroposophical Society was. But then a little later, I've got one more reading of with Harwood. He went on walks. Lewis loved to take walks. And Harwood was a good friend, after all. So he went and took a walk with Harwood, and you've got to hear this description. It's just Vintage Lewis as a describer. Next morning, having my great coat and suitcase in at the hotel, leaving it, and retaining a rucksack and a mock, I climbed the steep hill to Harwood's billet, and I collected him. You have to know that the English always collect you. John Stott would say, Earl, I'm going to come over and collect you at about 10. That's very British. So I collected him. Now listen to this, folks. This is wonderful. His children are now so numerous that one ceases to notice them individually. One ceases to notice them individually any more than a scuffle of piglets in a field or a waddle of ducks. A few platoons of them, now he's added all these different images, a few platoons of them accompanied us for the first mile of the walk, but then returned like tugboats when we were out of the harbor. I mean, you have to admit, don't you wish you could describe like that? And that's Lewis the Describer, the man of letters. So, and he loved, he loved to write letters. Lewis wrote letters. I shouldn't say he loved to, but he called it a duty. Did you know that Lewis answered every letter he got? Right up to the very end of his life, he was answering letters. The one thing he complained about just before he went into his final coma was, I don't know how I'm going to get my letters written, because his brother was on a drunken trip to Ireland, and his brother used to type a lot of the letters he would write. So he wrote letters, and he answered letters faithfully to people. Here's a funny one, because I'm from California. I'm used to be at Berkeley, and I love this letter he wrote in 1944 to the Society for the Prevention of Progress of Walnut Creek, California. They had offered him a membership in that society, Society for the Prevention of Progress. And in May of 1944, Lewis answered their letter this way. I love this. While feeling that I was born a member of your society, I am nevertheless honored to receive the outward seal of membership. I shall hope by continued orthodoxy and the unremitting practice of reaction, obstruction, and stagnation, I will give you no reason for repenting your favor. And also he answered letters by children. School children wrote him letters. I once gave a lecture at Regent College in Canada years ago. And I just said, innocently in the lecture, I said, have any of you here received a letter from C.S. Lewis? And do you know about 8 people raised their hands? 8 people in that huge audience had received letters from C.S. Lewis. And I asked each one what it was. They all had received them as school children, writing an assignment, and Lewis answered them. And here's an example. A girl wrote him a letter in which she asked him to reflect on, to give her opinion, his opinion on something she wrote. And he plays the role of literary critic and gives his opinion on what she wrote. He makes a few very modest corrections in what she said. He says, you talked about a wonderful night and all. And he urges her not to use language like that. And then she asked about saying amped or aren't and that. And he says, well, he says, about aren't and am I not, of course there are no right or wrong answers about language in the sense of which there's a right or wrong answer in arithmetic. Good English is whatever educated people talk. So what is good in one place would not be necessarily in another place. So he answers her questions. But then he says, what really matters is this. Listen to this. Listen, if you're a writer, to this advice from C.S. Lewis. What really matters is this. One, always try to use the language so as to make quite clear, remember W.T. Kirkpatrick? To make quite clear what you mean and make sure your sentence couldn't mean anything else. Like Surrey is not wild. Don't say that. Two, always prefer the plain, direct word to the long, vague one. Don't implement promises. Keep them. Three, never use abstract nouns and when concrete ones will do. If you mean that more people died, don't say mortality rose. Just say more people died. In writing, don't use adjectives that merely tell us what you want us to feel about the thing you're describing. I mean, instead of telling us a thing was terrible, describe it so that we'll be terrified. Don't say it was delightful. Make us say delightful when we've read your description. You see, all these words, horrifying, wonderful, hideous, exquisite. By the way, that was his most hated of all words. He hated it when people said something was exquisite. Don't ever say that. They're only like saying to your readers, please, will you do my work for you? Don't use words too big for the subject. Don't say infinitely when you mean very. Otherwise, you'll have no word left when you want to talk about something really infinite. C.S. Lewis. Isn't that marvelous? Written to a schoolgirl. Because he took people seriously in writing his letters. And he wrote lots of letters. I'm going to give some more of those next week because they're marvelous. And then he gave speeches. I told you about his wartime speeches. And best of all, he wrote stories. And I'm going to have a whole evening on stories, so I'll save that. He wrote stories of the marvelous and how marvelous they are. And he shared his faith. He shared his faith, and for that we're grateful. We're grateful that after that great long talk with J.R.R. Tolkien, he came to know Jesus Christ, and he played a role in helping many people discover who Jesus Christ is, the great eucatastrophe of all time. And it'll help you understand the great golden lion, Aslan. It'll help you understand Ransom in Out of the Silent Planet and that hideous strength, the goodness of God at work. And it'll help you understand Lewis himself.